from Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship, this is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, December 23, 2003. At KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Deepa Fernandes. Controversy mounting worldwide, and especially in the Arab world, over how and where to try Saddam Hussein. A new study by the Health and Human Services Department shows that African Americans are 30% more likely to die from cancer than white Americans. And Argentines remember 2 years ago when their country plummeted into chaos. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, a Green Party official announced that Ralph Nader is not running for president, at least as a Green. However, the consumer advocate may consider running as an independent. Democrats blame Nader for spoiling the election for Vice President Al Gore's bid for the White House in 2000. Green spokespersons were unclear about Nader's reasons for the decision. Nader aides say he wants to run a serious campaign and is trying to figure out how to best do that. The Pentagon cannot force U.S. soldiers to take anthrax vaccinations unless the president signs a special order, according to a federal judge. Kelly Ramirez has more.
Service members refusing the anthrax vaccine have faced punishments, including court-martial. But Judge Emmett G. Sullivan, who issued a preliminary injunction, noted that the rate of adverse reaction was recently revised upward from 0.2% to between 5 and 35%, and six people have died. Joyce Riley, spokesperson for the American Gulf War Veterans Association, welcomes the ruling, but she says that won't be the end of forced vaccines.
I think this is going to be a big battle. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld just announced that we're going to leave it up to the lawyers. Meanwhile, we've got thousands of people whose health has been affected and whose careers have been affected, and we cannot wait any longer. The credibility of the Department of Defense is absolutely at stake here. We can no longer have our military run by a group of individuals who do not put the health and welfare of our military first.
For FSRN, I'm Kelly Ramirez.
The United Nations Special Nuclear Agency is preparing to inspect sites in Libya. From the UN, Heather Risby reports.
In a statement, Mohammed al-Baradi, the head of Vienna-based International Atomic Energy Agency, has said he would visit Libya as early as next week. His statement came after the Libyan leader Muammar al-Gaddafi's announcement last week that Libya was ready to give up its nuclear weapons program. Libya has already signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but the protocol allows for tougher inspections of nuclear sites on a short notice. Many countries around the world, including Libya's neighbor Egypt, has welcomed Gaddafi's decision and have urged Israel to eliminate its nuclear arsenals. In a statement, Kofi Annan said all countries must fully implement disarmament treaties. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
Chile's former military dictator Augusto Pinochet is being challenged again by people who say their loved ones were killed or tortured during his U.S.-backed 17-year reign. Jolien Atwal reports from Santiago.
Human rights lawyers today handed over a petition to Judge Juan Guzman, arguing that an interview shown last month on a Miami television station proves that Pinochet is not senile. During the interview, the 88-year-old made several references to events from the 1970s. Prosecuting lawyers say that this demonstrates he has a good memory and that he should face trial for his involvement in Operation Condor, a ruthless series of kidnappings and murders carried out by his secret police. Pinochet's legal team has successfully argued on several occasions that Pinochet's supposed mild senility makes him unfit to face prosecution. Judge Guzman was forced to drop charges against Pinochet last week in a separate case when conservative Supreme Court judges refused to strip the ex-dictator of his legal immunity. More than 3,000 people died at the hands of Pinochet's regime from 1973 to 1990, and tens of thousands more were tortured or forced into exile. This is Jolien Atwell for Free Speech Radio News in Santiago, Chile.
Cuba had a banner diplomatic year. President Fidel Castro and revolutionary compadre President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela ended a secret meeting on Monday, 110 miles north of Caracas. Venezuela is Cuba's largest political ally and trade partner in Latin America. Opponents of Chavez, who are trying to oust him in a referendum, point to the meeting as an example of how the leader is attempting to convert Venezuela to communism. However, just last month, financial analysts said Chavez's policies, designed to most benefit Venezuela's poor, are boosting the overall economy. Also, Mexico's Vice Minister of Foreign Relations announced they too would be seeking closer ties with Cuba. Reportedly, after considerable pressure from the current Bush administration, relations between the two Latin nations cooled. Now that relations between Fox and Bush are a bit chilly, Mexico and Cuba are looking to reestablish closer ties. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
South Korea today moved to send 3,000 troops to Iraq, while Russia made a confidential offer to write off two-thirds of Baghdad's debt in return for oil exploration concessions. Violence is continuing despite the arrest of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and controversy is mounting over the planned trial of the ousted Iraqi leader. The human rights arm of the United Nations said it hopes Saddam Hussein's trial would meet, quote, international standards, and reiterated its opposition to the death penalty. And as Ulla Farawati reports from Amman, the debate in the Arab world over how to try Saddam Hussein is intensifying.
A Jordanian columnist wrote in a Ra'i newspaper today that the capture of deposed Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein proved to be a security achievement, but also a diplomatic trap, and in the Arab world. And although Hussein is widely considered here as a butcher, many voices are calling for a fair trial for him. Mshari Al-Anjari is deputy speaker for the Kuwaiti House of Deputies.
A group of Iraqis and Kurds and even Kuwaitis should take part in the trial of Saddam Hussein.
The United States is pushing for Saddam Hussein to be tried by a U.S.-created war crimes tribunal and not the International Criminal Court, which the U.S. does not endorse. The move to create a new U.S.-run war crimes court is angering many here, who categorically believe that Hussein will not receive a fair trial at the hands of the United States. Sabah al-Mukhtar is president of the Arab Lawyers Union in the UK. He spoke to Al Arabiya Satellite Channel.
There are many experiences in Iraq and Arab countries trying war criminals. We know how to do it, and Saddam Hussein should be tried according to Arab laws and by Arab objective judges, not those handpicked by the U.S.
Even so, Jordan's Bar Association called for the deposed Iraqi leader to be handed over to a, quote, neutral country or the International Committee of the Red Cross, rather than have to stand trial. Iraqi politician Ghassan Atiyeh, however, said the story of Saddam Hussein should be used to foster unity among Iraqis.
This trial should be used to show the world we can rule ourselves by ourselves. We should show the world we can be fair and transparent. We should also use this trial to foster our unity in the face of a bloody past and a dark present with the occupying power.
Arabs also have realized the U.S. lie in portraying the capture of Saddam Hussein as a victory. Independent resources say the Kurds have drugged and captured Hussein and handed him to U.S. occupying forces. Arab analyst Ramzi Baroud wrote Tuesday that Hussein remains a symbol of the vicious dictator who brutally crushed any hint of suggestion of dissent. The survivors and the descendants of his victims were dancing the streets of Iraq, celebrating the end of an era, but they are hardly celebrating the dawning of a new one. In Amman, Jordan, I'm Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
A new study by the Health and Human Services Department shows that African Americans are 30% more likely to die from cancer than white Americans. This study is released at the same time as another study by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities that shows as many as 1.6 million low-income people have been kicked off health benefits due to state budget cuts. Mitch Jeserich has the story from Capitol Hill.
This week, the Department of Human and Health Services released two studies in which it calls the first national measure of quality and access to health care. An alarming statistic in the study shows that African Americans have a 10% higher rate of having cancer and a 30% higher rate of dying from it than do Caucasians. The study shows that people who live near the poverty line also have a higher rate of dying from cancer. Researchers at the Health and Human Service Department told FSRN they don't know why such a disparity exists, but they plan to study that next. They would likely find some answers by looking at the neighborhoods where poor people live in, says Dr. Stephen Thomas, the director of the Center for Minority Health at the University of Pittsburgh.
We're still distributing tobacco in locations that teenagers have access to. We're still advertising and promoting tobacco use. We've made progress, but we have a long way to go. We still have neighborhoods in our inner cities that do not have grocery stores. If we want people to consume more fruits and vegetables, we also need to make sure that they have access. You cannot ask people to increase their physical activity when they live in neighborhoods that are not safe. You cannot ask people to go out and walk and increase their physical activity when they don't have sidewalks, when they don't have recreational facilities.
Along with the lack of healthcare access, Dr. Thomas points to a study done last year that indicates racist tendencies by healthcare professionals that results in poorer quality of care. The study by the Institute of Medicine called Unequal Treatment suggested minorities are less likely to receive needed services, including necessary clinical procedures. The Unequal Treatment study further suggests that even well-intentioned white healthcare professionals have exhibited prejudice tendencies towards minority clients. Again, Dr. Thomas.
Even when minority groups have the same ability to pay, that even when they have the same condition, they have the same symptoms, they get treated with poor service compared to whites.
Another study released this week indicates more discouraging trends. A study by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities suggests that as many as 1.6 million poor people lost state-offered health care insurance like Medicaid in the last 2 years. In many states that have budget deficits, most legislatures have chosen to cut medical benefits rather than raise taxes, says Leighton Koo, who is one of the study's researchers.
So because they have these huge budget deficits, they're not willing to increase taxes or revenues. Cuts are the only thing that remain on the table. Medicaid and the children's health insurance programs are things that they can cut.
And what is significantly being cut, Koo says, is child health care programs that were once considered untouchable. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities show that such states as Indiana, Maryland, Kentucky, and Texas have made it harder for low-income children to maintain eligibility. Also in California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is proposing to stop enrolling low-income children into its health care program and to stop admitting immigrants in other health care programs as well. There are about 14 states that are not cutting back on eligibility to their health care systems. In fact, the study shows Illinois has actually increased eligibility for its programs. I'm Mitch Jezerich for Free Speech Radio News.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. With national elections in Serbia set for this weekend, there's growing concern about the re-emergence of hardline nationalist parties in the Balkans. Nationalists who fought each other during the disintegration of Yugoslavia have returned to power in Bosnia and Croatia and are on the ascent in Serbia, with elections looming. Sputnik Kolumbi reports.
After Bosnia last year, it was Croatia's turn to return nationalists to power. The November general election saw the Croatian Democratic Union, HDZ, a party founded by Croatia's former strongman Franjo Tudjman, garner most of the votes. Tudjman was celebrated at home as the father of the nation, but elsewhere, he and his party were seen as a stronghold of hostility towards Serbs and a safe haven for war criminals. Serbia, for its part, has been lurching from crisis to crisis since the March assassination of pro-West Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic. Measures taken by his successor, Zoran Živković, such as the crackdown on organized crime, the extradition of some war criminals, and economic changes in line with international financial institutions, have been welcomed by the West, but have increased polarization in Serbia itself. Many now fear that a repeat could be played out in Serbia, that nationalist radicals, many allied with the former Milosevic regime, could stage a comeback in the upcoming general elections. For Zarko Puhavski, president of Croatia's Helsinki Committee for Human Rights, one thing all political leaders in countries from ex-Yugoslavia have in common is that the logic of nationalism helps when you're in trouble.
The majority of politicians in all the post-Yugoslav nations are indeed nationalists, in essence, if not always in form. They always accept the logic of sacrificing individuals for the sake of higher national aims.
The situation in Serbia is even more ominous, according to Dušan Janjić from the Belgrade-based NGO Forum for Interethnic Relations. The extremist Serbian radical party, headed by war crime suspect Vojislav Šešelj, is flush with optimism following its victory in last month's abortive presidential elections. That poll was declared invalid because of low turnout.
The crisis in Serbia is deepening because of two things. Because it did not face up to the consequences of the Milosevic regime and did not clean it up. And because the democratic leadership that took over came across as weak, divisive, and ultimately undemocratic.
The rise of nationalism isn't specific to Serbia or the Balkans, argues Dušan Janjić. Šešelj and his radicals, for example, he adds, have never won as many votes as France's extreme right leader Jean-Marie Le Pen. Austria, Italy, and recently Switzerland have all seen hardline nationalists elected to parliament. However, while Šešelj awaits trial in The Hague, his Serbian radical party has been trying to put on a new, softer face, the only way of gaining more public support today. Having realized that war led nowhere, says Dušan Janjić, they're now articulating popular dissatisfaction.
They say now that they will save socially owned enterprises, provide jobs for people, establish a policy of low prices for bread and other staples, and in combination with nationalism, it looks like a solid guarantee to people getting poorer, and they represent the majority of citizens of Serbia. According to European standards, 80% of citizens in Serbia are poor.
Although populism and nationalism are still the weapons of choice in political games in the Balkans, politicians are out of step with public opinion, says Zarko Puhovski. But that doesn't stop them from trying to manipulate people, he adds, who for the most part are simply trying to make ends meet.
But the next question is how far they will go to implement it, because when they get into power, they will have to abandon some of their fiery rhetoric, and then it'll be discovered that some pre-election promises cannot be fulfilled.
Pollsters, however, are treading warily ahead of the parliamentary elections, given their catastrophically incorrect predictions the last time round. But while it's safe to assume that radical nationalists will poll well, they will probably not win enough votes to form the next government. But no single party is expected to emerge as the overall winner. In a nutshell, Serbia's political crisis is far from over. Sputnik Kilambi reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
The 19th and 20th of December 2001 changed the history of Argentina. In conjunction with an economic collapse came a collapse of the political system. In a popular uprising that left 30 dead due to police repression, Argentines once more kicked out their president, this time Fernando de la Rúa. This past weekend marked 2 years since the economic collapse, and on Saturday, more than 40,000 members of popular assemblies, occupied factories, and piqueteros, or unemployed workers, once again yelled "Que se vayan todos," or "They must all leave," as they marched to the Plaza de Mayo. Pablo Biodo and Pauline Bartolone report from Buenos Aires.
After the 20th of December, new social movements emerged on the streets of Buenos Aires. Neighbors gathered on street corners to form what are now called popular assemblies. Factory owners abandoned business, leaving the workers to organize themselves collectively. Unemployment rose to 22% virtually overnight, making way for a new movement of unemployed workers, or piqueteros, who blocked roads to demand work. As tens of thousands of Argentines marched to the Plaza de Mayo, many remember the 32 killed by police repression 2 years ago. Gabriel, a motorbike messenger, joined the procession of family members of those killed, and remembered his fellow bike messenger who died under the De La Rúa government repression.
They were human beings. They had families. They got tired of the situation like the rest of the Argentinian people. and they came to say enough, and they were found dead at the hands of the police, who used lead bullets on them, under the chaos of the government of De La Rúa and Cavallo.
According to those who marched last Saturday, the social and economic problems continue in Argentina. Unemployment remains at 16%, and more than half of the population lives under the poverty line. Viviana from the unemployed workers movement Teresa Rodriguez says Argentina's President Kirchner is not resolving the problem of unemployment by signing an agreement with the IMF.
We are not in the crisis that we were in 2001, but this government hasn't done what it promised to do when it came to power. There's a lot more unemployment, and that has not been resolved. We still have problems with malnutrition. The problem of privatizations have not been resolved. In fact, it's growing. They just signed an agreement with the IMF to pay them $12.7 billion.
Two years ago in Argentina emerged the phenomenon of worker-controlled factories. Today, more than 150 factories continue production without owners. One of the most famous occupied factories is the Brooklyn textile plant in Buenos Aires. Since workers took control of the plant on December 18, 2001, they have resisted three eviction orders carried out by the batons and tear gas of Argentinian police. Celia Martinez of Brookman marched with her co-workers to say that others can follow their example.
It is just and necessary to reclaim our source of work, to be able to provide what our homes need with a dignified wage. And we also provided some hope for our fellow unemployed workers, telling them that they can open factories, they can start production as workers without an owner, without help of the government.
The piqueteros say that although the new government promises to confront the problem of unemployment, they also accuse Kirchner's administration of attempting to criminalize social protest. In response to lawsuits against and marginalization of the piqueteros, Diego from Popular Assembly Núñez says that the social movements in Argentina are redefining their identity.
There are less people in the movements now, but now they're discussing things like autonomy, addressing questions like what roles our leaders and governments play in our movement, and what we want as a country from the grassroots. There is nobody telling us what we have to do or how we have to live. It's a hard situation. There are internal problems in the movement. I don't call it fragmentation, rather plurality. The people continue to struggle.
During the demonstration at the downtown Buenos Aires Plaza de Mayo on Saturday, an explosive planted by unknown sources detonated and injured 23 unemployed workers. Monday, another march will take place to demand an investigation into the explosion. For Free Speech Radio News, we are Pablo Boedo and Pauline Bartolone in Buenos Aires.
Australia's Foreign Minister Alexander Downer visited Indonesia last week to discuss ways of fighting terrorism. Australia had decided to join the US in developing long-range ballistic missiles, and responding to Australia's decision, Jakarta said the missiles will endanger security in the region. Meanwhile, at the conference of the Council for Security Cooperation in the Asia-Pacific region, Indonesia's Minister of Defence announced Indonesia's involvement in an alliance to fight against terrorism. Yet as Maggie Mariano reports from Jakarta, while there are calls for dialogue between Muslim countries and the Western world, many Muslims in Indonesia are skeptical of working with the United States.
The Indonesian Muslims singing for holy war. The Muslim troops will never be there. They sing during a protest against the U.S. Hostility against the U.S. here is ever growing, saying the U.S. declaration on so-called war against terrorism. Hidayat Nur Wahid is chairman of a hardliner Muslim organization, the Justice and Prosperity Party. He mobilizes tens of thousands of young Muslims for various protests against the U.S.
Hostility against the U.S. here is not necessarily monopolized by Indonesian Muslims. It is, rather, a hostility of all people who reject capitalism and imperialism.
More than 50 blasts have happened in Indonesia since 2000. The Bali blast killed more than 200, most of them Australians. The blast led Australia to intensify its involvement in so-called war against terrorism. Mahindra Datta is the lawyer of the bombers. Two of his clients are now serving for death penalty. Others are serving more than 10 years jail.
The subject of terrorism is a huge propaganda conspiracy by the U.S. In the Southeast Asian region, Australia manages the so-called war on terrorism. Unfortunately, many parties are blinded by the propaganda.
Responding to the bombing, Indonesia issued a U.S.-sponsored anti-terrorism bill. The bill authorized the Indonesian intelligence to detain people in sacred place for more than 9 months without any lawyer advocacy. Human rights activists here worry that the bill will restore military repressive power and renew U.S. intervention in the country. Samandia Yarifi is deputy director of the New York-based Human Rights Watch.
We know that the United States is pushing many countries to focus on the war against terror. And many countries are using the excuse of the war against terror to attack their own critics and their own opponents.
Muslim communities saying the bill endangers their freedom. More than 20 Muslim activists in Indonesia are now in sacred detention. This week, Sigmo Indonesian students were deported to Jakarta after being apprehended in Pakistan and charged with aiding terrorism. Again, Hidayat Nur Wahid of the Justice and Prosperity Party.
Something we were wary of is now coming into reality. The anti-terrorism bill has justified illegal detentions.
In 2003 alone, more than 6 bombs blasted in Indonesia, with a recent blast at a U.S.-owned JW Marriott hotel in Indonesia in August. Risha Sheikh Budi is an international expert in Jakarta.
The definition of terrorist is actually unclear. I think that terrorism means any violence against civilians. So not just Al-Qaeda and Jama'at al-Islam that are identified as terrorists, but the U.S. also should be identified as terrorists, since the U.S. kills civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan. Israel is also a terrorist for killing Palestinian civilians.
Still, hostility against the U.S. here is ever growing. America is terrorist and George Bush is cannibal, the youth crying in various rallies here. For Free Speak Radio News, Maggie Margiono reporting from Indonesia.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Kata Mesta and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. Our DC editor is Mitch Jeserich. The technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Million, and Lindsay Benedict. Web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. Our intern is Bob Stern. FSRN is a worker-run collective, and for more information, visit our website at www.fsrn.org. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.